wandering and serving what was put in front of me. Such was the case on the day I found myself chairing a Medical Manager Corporation board meeting specifically called to discuss the proposed merger with Synetic. Medical Manager had a very active board of directors, many of whom had tremendous business experience, including a previous treasurer of General Motors. The board was seriously considering our various options going forward. We had done $140 million of business the previous year versus Synetic's $70 million. But the tremendous potential value of its web portal had pushed Synetic's market value way beyond ours and made the company an attractive partner. In the end, the board unanimously decided to accept Synetic's $1.3 billion offer for the company. I, of course, had never been involved in a billion-dollar merger before, but we had great outside counsel and a good team of bankers to assist us. I turned to Sabrina to work by my side on this enormous project. Marty had put the merger on the fast track, and all the details had to be worked out in a few weeks. We worked day and night to get the final deal presented to both boards, and the merger was announced publicly on May 17, 1999. The merger between Medical Manager Corporation and Synetic created quite a stir. It was the main business story on CNN that evening and was prominent in the Wall Street Journal the next day. The new company kept the Medical Manager Corporation name, and John Kang and I were co-CEOs and sat on the board of directors with Marty as chairman. Though I still lived at the Temple of the Universe and simply drove across the street to get to work, my world had instantly expanded. My responsibilities now stretched beyond the practice management business and included all the areas of business Marty's team had been working on. In truth, that was the most exciting part of the merger. I now had an entire team of world-class executives to work with. Marty surrounded himself with the best of the best, and it was really an honor to get to work with these people. As it turned out, Synetic's main competitors were our old friends, WebMD and Healthion, who had merged together by now. Their combined company provided serious competition for our healthcare internet portal. The question was simply one of time. Would there be enough time for us to build out our highly sophisticated web offering before Healthion WebMD attracted too much of the available funding? The answer to that question came on January 25th, 2000, just 6 months after our merger with Synetic. We awoke to the news that Healthion WebMD had managed to acquire Envoy, the largest claims clearinghouse in the industry, for $2.5 billion. That was quite an acquisition, considering that Healthion WebMD was a web startup company reporting enormous losses, and Envoy was a well-established, highly profitable clearinghouse for healthcare transactions. It was quickly determined that we could not maintain a competitive position in light of this deal. From Medical Manager's point of view, the deal meant that our competitor now owned the clearinghouse through which we were channeling all of our clients' hundreds of millions of claims a year. There were times when I was very glad I was no longer in charge. Late January 2000 was definitely one of them. Chapter 48, Building Rome in a Day. Marty was calm and collected at the ensuing board meeting. In fact, he seemed even sharper than usual. It turned out that he was just as good at playing downside situations as he was at leveraging upside opportunities. He went over the options with the board, and it was decided we had best try to negotiate a decent merger agreement with Healthion WebMD. It was a classic case of, if you can't beat 'em, join 'em. The problem was that we were well aware that the underpinnings of Healthion WebMD were very weak. The company had been built up based solely on the vision of future performance, yet the market was valuing it at $7 billion. Unfortunately, our most promising road to success meant merging with them and doing the hard work necessary to make it all a reality. As unbelievable as it seems, Medical Manager Corporation and Healthy on WebMD announced their merger agreement just 3 weeks after we learned of the Envoy deal. It was on Valentine's Day, February 14th, 2000. The deal valued Medical Manager Corporation at $3.5 billion, and Wall Street characterized it as the merger of two behemoths in the healthcare industry. It drew headlines everywhere. The announcement pushed Medical Manager's stock price to a peak of $86 a share. This can be compared to $17.60 per share when we went public 3 years earlier. The joy was short-lived. The infamous internet bubble, caused by overinflated expectations for internet companies, began to burst just weeks after the merger announcement. We had not even closed the deal, yet by April 2000, Healthy on WebMD had already lost 70% of its value. Our stock fell accordingly because it was tied to their stock by the merger agreement. It was all pretty much a disaster, and the only hope left was to do the hard work necessary to restructure the entire company. The task was Herculean. WebMD was the quintessential internet company, and the internet bubble had just burst. WebMD's stock had once traded above $100 per share. It was at $17.50 when we closed the deal, on its way to a low of $3 in August 2001. This called for drastic measures, and that is what it got. Within a month of closing, Marty became chairman of the board, and he and his elite management team were running the company. I remained CEO of the Practice Services Division and sat on the board of directors of the combined company, which kept the name WebMD. Marty brought in a seasoned turnaround specialist, Marv Rich, to be president during the massive reorganization. The company was losing hundreds of millions of dollars a year, and the bleeding had to be stopped. Marv's job was to work his way through all the divisions and cut them down to core competency. All that would remain was that which was aligned with WebMD's core vision and could quickly begin earning its keep. The task before us was breathtaking, and it provided tremendous growth for me personally. I now found myself part of a team of executives who, instead of complaining, simply rolled up their sleeves and tackled this monumental project. Everyone was working day and night to do whatever was needed to right the sinking ship. For years, I had been diligently working to free myself of that weak person inside who always insisted on things being the way he wanted. Now, nothing was the way anyone would have wanted. Yet everyone just took a collective deep breath and did whatever was asked of them. It was an amazing thing to be part of, and it taught me a lesson of inner strength that permanently changed me at a very deep level. Marv called me one day and asked me to accompany him to California, where the WebMD internet site was being developed. If the company we had merged with had a main asset, this was it. Marv wanted me to act as a development specialist at meetings with the website's development team. Most of the company's losses were being generated by its internet offerings, and this had to be dealt with. The problem was that despite the losses, the development team was making enormous demands for salaries and benefits from the new WebMD management. They figured they were in the driver's seat since they controlled the development of the company's entire internet offering. I couldn't believe what I saw when we arrived. More than 800 developers were working in a giant converted warehouse in Silicon Valley. It was tiny cubicle after tiny cubicle, as far as the eye could see. I thought my development team in Alatra had expanded tremendously. We were about 250 people, but this development team was over three times that size, and everyone was packed in like sardines. Unfortunately, the meetings didn't last very long. Marv and I sat with their senior management team and listened to their demands. They had the demands nicely printed out in great detail on many pages. When they were done, Marv presented what he was willing to offer, which fit on one short page. The heads of development met amongst themselves, and after a very short period of time, came back to Marv with their reply. Meet our demands, or we're leaving. I had so much to learn from people like Marty and Marv, and I was completely open to the process. I would have thought that the next step was to figure out who we couldn't live without and bite the bullet. That's not what happened. Marv spent a few minutes relaxing quietly, got up from his chair, and motioned me to walk with him. He left the meeting room and called together the entire development team right then and there in the open cubicle area. He explained that the top tier of their management had just resigned, and anyone who wanted to go with them should make that decision at this time. Those who wished to stay would not be guaranteed a job, but over the next few weeks, we would work together to see who was needed to keep the core development going. And that was that. Marv left a few of his people in charge of sorting out the exodus, and we left. The only thing Marv ever said to me about the whole affair was that if you let people hold you hostage, they will force you to make terrible decisions, and you will lose. You might as well take your bumps up front and at least be in control of your destiny. Who would have believed that just a few months later, one of Marty's senior executives would move the development of the website to New York and relaunch it with a team of less than 40 developers? That new website became the foundation for WebMD's entire future. Again and again, I was seeing that each of these intensely challenging business experiences was very beneficial for my spiritual growth. I just kept letting go of whatever discomfort got stirred up within me, and inevitably, a stronger flow of spiritual energy took its place. This growing strength helped to prepare me for life's next growth experience. What happened when Marv's reorganization team finally got around to taking aim at my division? Medical Manager Practice Services Division, as we were known at the time, was one of the largest divisions in WebMD. We had grown to almost 2,000 employees, and that made us very ripe for cost-cutting. With that in mind, Marv brought the reorganization team down to Alachua for 2 days of meetings. The first day was devoted to presenting our business plan and vision for the future. Fortunately, we were well prepared to take Marv through our current products with their highly successful revenue generation, as well as the products and services we were working on for the future. It certainly didn't hurt when Sabrina was able to present the tremendous growth of Medical Manager Network Services from a few $100,000 a year to a $50 million a year business in just over 3 years. It was during these presentations that it really hit me what had happened. John Kang and I had set out to be sure that Medical Manager was not left behind by the enormous potential of internet companies like Healthion and WebMD. At the same time, Sabrina and I had been struggling to find a way to get Envoy or some other clearinghouse to evolve enough to be able to fulfill our vision for network services. Despite all the negative issues we were facing, the amazing reality was that when the smoke had cleared, we ended up owning all three of these companies, WebMD, Healthion, and Envoy. Just a short time ago, no one could have even imagined how such a thing could ever take place. It was like so much else I had experienced. The unimaginable had actually happened. The presentations to Marv and his team went very well. There was palpable excitement in the room throughout the day. Nonetheless, when I returned later that evening, I was shocked to see what had happened to the meeting room. Stretched around the walls of the room were computer printouts with the names of all the Medical Manager Practice Services Division's 2,000 employees. Hanging like wallpaper, they foreshadowed the day planned for tomorrow. Every name on the list would need to be justified. I was aghast, especially since we had recently requested additional employees to keep up with our growth. Returning home that evening, I was very concerned about the fate of my employees. Tomorrow could turn out to be a very ugly day. At the same time, I knew that Marv had to cut costs, and it was my job as a corporate executive to help him. This could have created a lot of inner tension, but I decided to just surrender to the reality of the situation and be open to balancing these two areas of concern. I came to peace that night, knowing my heart was in the right place, and when tomorrow came, I would do the best I could. The next morning, when I entered the room, I was again shocked by what I saw. The printouts had been taken down, and the walls were back to normal. Before I could inquire what was going on, Marv's second-in-command walked me out to the hall. He told me that he and Marv had met last night, and the decision was made to skip the bloodletting and allow us to continue the fine work we were doing. He told me they were very impressed with what we had achieved and with our plans for the future. As they saw no need for the second day of meetings, Marv had taken an early flight out. His team packed up, shook our hands, and went on their way. I have no idea to this day if the rest of my management team ever saw the ominous sight of those wallpapered walls. I realized just how extraordinary these events were when a few hours later I received a call from the head of HR at corporate headquarters in New Jersey. He was completely beside himself. He playfully asked me what I had used to drug Marv while he was down here in Alachua. He went on to say that he doubted that such an event had ever taken place in the annals of corporate history. We were all well aware that Marv's purpose in life was to cut costs, that he would come down here with that intention and simply walk away is a tribute to both the quality of our division and to Marv as a manager. Medical manager and I received a number of tributes in 2000, but none was more meaningful to me than receiving such a vote of confidence from someone I respected so much. Chapter 49, Hanging Out in Washington. The year 2000 not only ushered in a new millennium, it brought with it a flurry of recognition for the pinnacle of success that the medical manager had achieved. To me, who was just on the magic carpet for the ride, it was all simply a tribute to the perfection of life's flow. I had not sought any recognition. I had just thrown myself into life's wind to see where it would take me. I was invited by one of our previous board members, Ray Kurzweil, to join him at the White House in March, where he was to receive the National Medal of Honor in Technology. Ray is credited with many major inventions, including the first microchip that allowed an electronic keyboard to sound like a grand piano and other real instruments. He is also considered one of the fathers of speech recognition software. Ray had been on Medical Manager Corporation's board, and I had sat on Kurzweil Education Systems board. Through it all, we had become good friends. He even stayed with us at the temple a few times and showed a serious interest in Eastern philosophy. I would have to wear a tuxedo to the White House, which was far from my normal attire, but I was excited about joining Ray for this honor. Like many others, I had been to the White House as a tourist, but certainly not as a guest of the president. There was a cocktail party after the ceremony, and we were allowed to walk freely throughout the rooms of the first floor residence. I gazed out a window in the green room that overlooked the Washington Monument and thought about how many presidents had taken in that view. Getting used to actually sitting on the antique furniture in those rooms was difficult enough, but then I kept realizing that the people I was having conversations with were all National Medal of Honor winners in some field of science. President Clinton joined the mix, and I even ran into Stevie Wonder in the hallway. All in all, it was one of those "what am I doing here" moments. I'm a yogi who moved out to the woods to meditate. I surrender to the flow of life, and I end up here? Unbelievable. That was not my only trip to Washington that year. The very next month, I came back to represent the medical manager when it was installed into the archives of the Smithsonian Institution. The Smithsonian was sponsoring an effort to document the information technology revolution for future generations. In much the same way as we now look at the Industrial Revolution, someday people will be fascinated by the time period in which computers revolutionized how we live. Each year, a panel of CEOs of the world's leading IT companies did a search for organizations that had done extraordinary work in the field. Because of our work in the area of electronic healthcare transactions, Medical Manager was one of the companies selected in the year 2000 to have its story preserved in a time capsule for the future. There was a grand banquet the night before and a ceremony at the museum the next day. I brought a few of the old-time employees with me, as well as Donna and Durga. Reflecting back 20 years to when I was sitting in that 12-by-12-foot room in the woods, by myself, writing this program, one could never have imagined that it would lead to the Smithsonian. As it turned out, I would have to return to D.C. once again in August of 2000 on a very important trip. I had been asked to represent the company at a meeting with the Department of Justice, DOJ. Before larger companies can combine, the U.S. government reserves the right to determine if the combination could stifle competition and violate antitrust laws. In the case of the Healthion WebMD Medical Manager merger, the government requested very detailed information and a face-to-face meeting. The reason for this was that Medical Manager Network Services was sending so many claims to Envoy that the government was concerned about allowing us to become part of the same company. My immediate reaction to this situation was one of deep humility. Had Medical Manager actually reached the point of success that the U.S. government had to be concerned about the very antitrust laws I'd studied in business school? No, not really. But we were going to have to convince them of that. Sabrina and I flew up to Washington to prepare for the Justice Department meeting. It was around that time I began to notice that my life was becoming filled with more and more attorneys. We met for a strategy meeting at the office of one of the largest law firms in D.C. There were attorneys everywhere, but one always stood out from the rest. Jim Mercer was Marty's litigation specialist, and he understood both the law and business at a phenomenal level. I had learned to have great respect and confidence in Jim, and I was glad he would be present at the DOJ meeting. I, of course, had never previously dealt with the Justice Department. It was not exactly my everyday experience to be entering the DOJ building surrounded by a large team of attorneys. Nonetheless, after hours of very intense questioning, Sabrina and I managed to address the government's concerns satisfactorily. When it was all said and done, the merger was not going to pose any antitrust problems. Though we were all very relieved when the ordeal was over, it had actually turned out to be quite a learning experience. All this exposure to intensely powerful people and situations was having a profound effect on the psyche I watched so diligently. I had never been exposed to this powerful lifestyle. Nothing in me got off on it or wanted anything from it, but it did make me deal with parts of my being that I would not have faced otherwise. If I saw any weakness, fear, or anxiety come up, I just deeply relaxed back into where I was watching from. I simply kept letting go of whatever came up. This is where life had taken me, and I used all these situations as a way of letting go of myself. It was definitely working. I kept being pushed into strongly positive and negative situations, and I increasingly found myself in a very clear and undisturbed state. It seemed that the more challenges life put me through, the less my inner energy flow was affected by outer conditions. What years of willful meditation had not gotten rid of, life's situations and challenges were rooting out of me. As long as I made getting rid of myself my only goal, every situation was a fruitful experience. If I'd had any other goal, I think the constant pressure would have been overwhelming. I found that I actually got more peaceful inside as I dealt with the ever-increasing magnitude of challenges. Life was molding me each day to become who I needed to be in order to handle tomorrow's tasks. All I had to do was let go and not resist the process. For the next few years, my medical manager practice services division continued to grow to its peak financial success. We grew to more than 2,300 employees and were generating more than $300 million a year in revenue. We were the most widely installed practice management vendor in the country, and we had begun turning our attention toward building a fully computerized electronic health record. It was a period with tremendous challenges that I thought was putting me through unprecedented growth. Little did I know that life's portal of dramatic change was about to open up once again. When it did this time, it would completely redefine for me what it meant to go through a transformational growth experience. Section 9, Total Surrender. Chapter 50, The Raid. It was Wednesday, September 3rd, 2003. I remember because on Wednesdays I go into Gainesville in the morning to see Dr. Chance for a health tune-up. After the appointment, I noticed that I had a voicemail from Lisa Elliott, the resident attorney at the R&D facility in Alachua. She said it was very important, so I returned her call while still in the parking lot. I got Lisa on her cell phone, and she was very glad to hear from me. Her voice was uncharacteristically tense, and I realized that something was very wrong. She began by telling me that I needed to come to work right away because the FBI was there, and they wanted to see me. My first thought was about a federal marshal who had come to the facility a few years earlier looking for a prior employee. I asked Lisa if they were looking for someone. She said, "No, the FBI is here, 12 to 15 agents, plus the sheriff's department. They've taken over the entire facility. They've shut down all the phone lines and the entire computer system. This is a full-blown raid. Helicopters are flying overhead, agents are armed, and there's a search warrant. You need to come here right away." I clearly heard the words she was saying, and I understood the sense of urgency with which they were said. But the situation was so absurd that I could not relate to it in any manner. It was like, maybe they have the wrong address. I guess that's why it didn't disturb me. In fact, it sounded like it was going to be rather exciting getting to show them they'd made a mistake. I asked Lisa what was going on. Why were they there? She said she had no idea, but apparently the same thing was happening at her offices in Tampa and at corporate headquarters in New Jersey. She had been trying to call Charlie Mealy, our general counsel, but she couldn't get through. The phones were down corporate-wide. I assured her that I would be there right away. During the 20-minute drive back to the office, I tried calling everyone I could think of who might have some information. I still had absolutely no idea what was going on when I pulled up to the R&D facility. The front drive was completely blocked off with sheriff's department vehicles, and the employees showing up for work were being turned away. I pulled up to a deputy and identified myself. He made a call on his radio and immediately signaled to the others to let me through. As I drove up the long and winding drive through the beautiful hayfields, law enforcement vehicles were scattered everywhere. When I approached Building 1, I saw the Sheriff's Department's 40-foot mobile command center stretched across our parking lot. We had 5 buildings by then, and the FBI and Sheriff's Department personnel were positioned around all of them. There were, indeed, 2 helicopters buzzing overhead. I think they ended up being part of the media coverage. I parked in my normal spot and made my way into the building. the place was swarming with law enforcement officers. I was met by four or five agents who immediately walked me into the back conference room where I was to spend the day. I requested that our in-house attorney, Lisa, be present, and she was brought into the room. The agents identified themselves as from the FBI and the Treasury Department. They were very professional and businesslike. I was presented with a search warrant, which Lisa had already reviewed, and I was informed that the warrant gave them full control of the facility. They had the right to take any and all items that fell within the itemized categories. They asked me to sign a paper acknowledging that I had been served the warrant. I glanced at Lisa, and she nodded that I should sign. I had absolutely no idea what to do. I was completely out of my element. The only frame of reference I had for this sort of thing was the movies, and I doubted that was going to be of much help. I asked the agents in charge if they could help me understand what was going on. They didn't say much, but they referred me to a list of about 30 names that they said were persons essential to their investigation. The entire executive management team from the original Medical Manager Corporation was on the list, as were Marty, the attorney Jim Mercer, and some top people from WebMD's corporate accounting. My mouth must have been agape as I looked at the list. But there were also a few other names that really floored me, like the senior auditor from the highly respected public accounting firm we had used for Medical Manager Corporation. I was taking everything in very calmly, but my mind was spinning, trying to find clues about what was behind all of this. It was actually the presence of one name on the list that first caught my attention. The name was Pat Selechek. Unlike everyone else on the list, this person was neither part of our executive team nor part of legal or accounting. Pat worked on the dealer acquisition team, which was run by Bobby Davids, our VP of acquisitions. Bobby had come into the company at the time of the 1997 initial public offering, along with John Sessions, our chief operations officer, and David Ward, our VP of sales. I would hardly have recognized Pat's name out of our 2,300 division employees, except that we were currently in the process of investigating him for taking kickbacks from some of the dealers. That investigation had begun in late 2002, and by early 2003 had included Bobby Davids and a couple of other employees. WebMD's corporate attorneys, with the help of outside counsel, were handling the matter. We had already fired the people involved and sued them in a Tampa court in order to obtain subpoena power and freeze Bobby's and Pat's assets. As our investigation went on, we were finding more and more incidents of Bobby and or Pat arranging kickbacks from the dealers they were acquiring. The subpoenas we obtained of their bank accounts had revealed an intricate network of shell companies Bobby had been using to hide the money. The investigators were able to trace the funds coming in and going out of these accounts to see who was involved in the money trail. Pat had already begun to cooperate, and it was obvious that Bobby Davids was the ringleader. By the time of the raid, we had traced millions of dollars, and it was still an ongoing investigation. With both Pat's and Bobby's names on the list, and the search warrant listing more than 100 of our dealer acquisitions, it was likely that these raids were somehow related to what Bobby had been doing. But his kickback schemes involved only 4 or 5 employees, and our investigation of the matter was being dealt with in the open. Why couldn't the government just talk to the investigating attorneys? Why a sneak attack raid in Alachua, Tampa, and New Jersey when everything was readily available? I was finally able to get Charlie, WebMD's general counsel, on my cell phone. He confirmed that they had been raided by the FBI at WebMD's headquarters in New Jersey, and he was as much in the dark as I was. He also suspected that this might be associated with the illegal activity Bobby Davids had been involved in. We discussed the possibility that Bobby had tried to strike a deal by telling the government that all the executives were involved in his kickbacks. If so, it didn't seem likely that his story would hold up given all the hard evidence we had of his bank accounts and canceled checks. Charlie said that we would get more clarification over the next few days. In the meantime, we were to cooperate fully with the agents. A sense of total peace came over me and pretty much remained there the entire day. It was so thick, it felt like a protective blanket. I was not concerned in the least. I knew I had not done anything wrong, and therefore they were not going to find anything. If this was a case of Bobby lying to try to save his neck, the evidence would clearly reveal the truth. I wanted to make sure I was present enough to fully take in this extraordinary experience. It's not every day that the FBI shows up and raids your place for absolutely no apparent reason. My understanding is that nationwide, more than 50 government agents were involved in the raid. They took the entire day, and by the time they were done, they left with pretty much everything. My desk was cleared of every single scrap of paper. All my file cabinets were empty, as were those of my executive assistant, Sandy Plum. All legal files were removed from Lisa's office and from the legal filing room. My conference room table used to have stacks of file folders piled up that were actively being used to run the business. They were all gone, with no way to recreate them. And it was not just the paper documents that were being taken. Agents were also making mirror images of all our computer disk drives, both the desktops and the servers. The day progressed pretty much without my input. I used my time to work on remaining completely comfortable with the radical situation life had stuck me in. There was really no reason to be thinking about why this was happening or how it would turn out. Since I had absolutely no idea what was going on, thinking about it wasn't going to help. Instead, I enjoyed spending my day letting go of whatever that voice in my head was trying to say, and deeply relaxing whenever my heart began to feel anxious. In this situation, surrender was not an option. It was the only sane thing to do. When I left that evening, I sought out the lead agents. I thanked them for being so cordial and told them that I wish we could have met under better circumstances. To me, they were just people doing their jobs to the best of their ability. It certainly wasn't their fault. When the sun set on September 3, 2003, nationwide, the government had taken 1.2 million email messages, 1,500 boxes of files containing more than 3 million pages of documents, and 830,000 computer files. This was indeed a day that would live in infamy. Chapter 51. Attorneys, attorneys, and more attorneys. The next morning, I got a preview of what my life was going to be like for a while. The headlines of the Gainesville Sun read, FBI raids Alachua Medical Manager offices. Underneath was my picture, next to the story heading, Wall Street halts the trading of WebMD stock just before noon. I knew it didn't make any difference that I hadn't done anything, and that I didn't even know what the raid was all about. I was headline news. I had never been publicly disgraced before, and I noticed that it definitely stirred up the psyche. That voice inside my head kept wanting to explain that this had nothing to do with me. There was certainly no lack of people wanting to hear what I had to say. Media outlets from all over the country, including the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, were trying to reach me for a comment. Fortunately, I knew better. I had spent all these years quieting down that mental voice, and I had learned that listening to it only fuels the fire. I knew how powerful it was to simply relax and release past that urge to defend oneself. I resolved I would only discuss the matter when absolutely necessary. Otherwise, I would just go about my business as usual. I hadn't done anything wrong, so why should I let this affect me? Over time, it would work itself out. In the meantime, I was not going to let it steal the great peace and joy I felt deep inside. Right from the beginning, I resolved to use the whole situation to finally free myself from whatever was left of that scared person inside who had always held me back This was my entire journey. Liberation, at any cost. We had a conference call with the corporate attorneys first thing in the morning. No one could make sense of what had happened. Regardless, the first order of business was to hire an attorney. Well, not exactly an attorney. Separate law firms to represent both the company and the board of directors, and a criminal attorney for everyone whose name was on the list. I could see that the corporate attorneys were taking this very seriously. They explained that it didn't matter if you were as clean as a whistle. A raid of this magnitude foreshadowed major problems, and everyone needed legal representation. That meant at least 20 attorneys. I soon found out even that wasn't going to be enough. The investigation was coming out of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Charleston, South Carolina. So it was suggested that the senior executives also line up attorneys licensed to practice there. So now we were talking about hiring 30 or 40 attorneys, plus two firms for the company. If I hadn't been stunned by the raid, I was certainly going to be stunned by what it meant to defend yourself against it. I couldn't relate to suddenly being thrust into this situation. I knew absolutely nothing about criminal matters. I had never even thought about the subject. This made me very naive about the inherent danger I could be facing. If I had been left on my own, I probably would have figured that since I didn't do anything, I should just go in and talk to the government. Fortunately, I was surrounded by savvy business people who knew that you don't do anything until you consult an attorney and find out what's going on. I certainly learned the wisdom of that advice as events unfolded. Over the next few weeks, WebMD's board hired Williams and Connolly to represent the company. This firm was not the largest in Washington, but it had the reputation of being one of the best for this sort of case. I asked Jim Mercer, since he was the attorney I respected the most, to help me select my attorney. I was a novice, and he was an expert. I really appreciated all the help and support I got from him. Jim steered me to an attorney at Williams and Connolly, who gave me a list of highly respected criminal lawyers whom he had worked with in the past. It seemed like such a big decision. I wouldn't have any idea how to interview a top-notch criminal attorney. I followed Jim's advice and started to set up preliminary meetings with some of the attorneys. But in my heart, I knew I was going to leave this decision up to the flow of life. As it turned out, events unfolded such that I met with only one attorney, Randy Turk. Randy was a senior partner with Baker Botts, one of the country's oldest and most respected law firms. His resume read like a who's who in the white-collar criminal defense world. It ran from successfully defending Hughes Aircraft Company against a $400 million claim by the U.S. government regarding repair of the Hubble Space Telescope, to being one of the key lawyers on the defense team for Michael K. Deaver, Reagan White House Deputy Chief of Staff, at a trial of allegations of perjury and obstruction of justice. The list went on and on. Of all the information I could gather about Randy, it was something the attorney at Williams and Connolly said that influenced me the most. He had heard that I had a ponytail and lived in the woods. He told me that of all the top defense attorneys he knew, Randy was the most avant-garde. The attorney felt that based on what they had heard about me, Randy and I would get along great. I met Randy for the first time in New York. He flew in for the WebMD shareholder meeting to meet with me and Jim Mercer, who was helping me select my attorney. I was immediately comfortable with Randy. He had been defending people against government charges for more than 30 years. He practiced in Washington and was obviously very successful. Randy seemed to be intrigued by the case and my unique background. He had learned what he could from his contact at Williams and Connolly, and Jim and I proceeded to tell him what we knew. WebMD had gotten a much better idea of the focus of the government's investigation by the time Randy and I met. As we had suspected, Bobby Davids was behind all of this. After the company had successfully subpoenaed his hidden bank accounts in early 2003, Bobby knew he was caught. It was just a matter of time before we realized that he had stolen almost $6 million in kickbacks and embezzlement schemes. He was going to prison for a very long time. But Bobby was a con man, and apparently a very good one. He had certainly conned us for years, while managing to carry out his fraud undetected. In March 2003, Bobby Davids embarked on the con of his life, how to avoid punishment for what he had done. He walked into the U.S. Attorney's Office in Charleston, South Carolina, near where he lived, and presented himself as a whistleblower. He told the federal authorities that he was an executive who had been involved in massive accounting fraud at a public company. He admitted that as part of this fraud, he had taken kickbacks for himself and a few others, but he was prepared to turn in the entire upper management team if the government was prepared to cut him a deal. For the next 6 months leading up to the raid, while Webb and the attorneys were openly investigating all that Davids and his group had done, Bobby Davids was secretly hand-feeding the government an intricate web of lies. Davids was, in fact, a CPA in charge of the entire dealer acquisition program. As such, he had detailed knowledge of every acquisition and every supporting document. Davids was completely free to create the entire frame of reference for the government about the company and its executives. With the skill of a Picasso, he was painting a masterpiece on the blank canvas of people's minds. All he had to do was be sure he told the story in a way that would later be supportable by the documents they would find. He knew there was not going to be any hard evidence found to support his world according to Bobby. But if he says that he was told to do a deal in a certain way, and he could later show that indeed the deal was done that way, that would support his story. The problem is that it would not support the he was told part. But if he tells the government investigators what they're going to find, and they keep finding it, that would lend credence to the rest of his story. Eventually, he would earn their confidence. If knowledge is power, then Bobby Davids had all the power. In that early interaction with the government, he was the one with all the knowledge. Randy explained that this was not an unusual situation. The government forms a view and then tries to find evidence to support that view. That is what the FBI was currently doing with the mass of documents taken during the raid. Randy said, the problem with that many documents is that you can always find a way to make them say what you want. On that ominous note, Randy agreed to defend me to the best of his ability, and we shook hands. I could never have known the odyssey we were about to embark on together, nor could I have known how close our friendship would become. All I knew at the time was that the same flow of life's events that had led me into this mess had just led me to my lead attorney. Following this flow was my great experiment, and there was no turning back now. Chapter 52, United States of America versus Michael A. Singer. 4 months had passed since the raid, and we still knew very little about what was going on. I continued to feel confident that as the government investigators worked their way through the documents and interviewed people in the company, they would realize that Bobby and his group were the only ones who had done anything wrong. The headlines had stopped, and everything was relatively back to normal in our daily lives. Randy came down to Alachua once or twice, as did a few members of his team. Since we didn't know what case the government was trying to build, and they had taken all the documents from 1997 through 2003, there was not much legal work we could be doing. The only thing the executives could do was start getting our attorneys up to speed regarding our business and personal histories. Randy selected a South Carolina attorney for me, John Simmons, and shortly thereafter, John came down to see me. I was very impressed with him. John had been the U.S. attorney for South Carolina in the past and was now in private practice. As we spent the day together, and he saw what I had built over the years with the business and the temple, he grew more and more dismayed at what was going on. He told me he knew the prosecutor leading the investigation, and she was a fine, intelligent woman. Like everyone else involved, John wondered how Bobby had managed to pull her into his world. Randy told me that these large, white-collar investigations were measured in years, not months. He said there wasn't much for us to do until the government investigators had worked through what they had seized and were prepared to discuss their case. He did say that we could contact the prosecutor and inquire about my status on the list. I was shocked to learn I was one of the chief targets of the investigation. This did not surprise Randy. The government was headhunting, and because I had been CEO, that put me at the top of the list. Regardless, I continued to believe that since they weren't going to find anything, I had nothing to worry about. I believed that in the end, truth would triumph. In the meantime, the company moved forward aggressively with its defense. A firm was hired to finish off the internal investigation of Bobby's kickback schemes. Just because he had somehow managed to get the government on his side didn't mean that he hadn't stolen from the company. In addition, the company set out to show that it was not true that there was rampant accounting fraud going on in the company. The board hired a forensic accounting firm to perform a detailed audit of revenue and earnings of the Medical Manager Practice Services Division for the entire year of 2001. As a public company, it was very important to protect WebMD from getting pulled into this mess. Fortunately, they were successful. As part of isolating the company from the investigation of the individual medical manager executives, in July 2004, I stepped down as CEO of the division. Later that year, as the investigation heated up, I also stepped down from WebMD's board of directors. I saw this as another act of surrender of the personal in order to serve what life was doing. I just relaxed and let go of whatever resistance came up inside of me. That is how I had been handling this entire ordeal, and it made that period of my life a profound and powerful part of my spiritual journey. January 2005 brought the next major step in the process. The government accepted plea agreements from Bobby Davids and two of his collaborators in the kickback schemes. These people agreed to pay restitutions to the company, and Bobby agreed to serve a year and a day in prison. Not bad, considering what was all said and done, he admitted to stealing $5.4 million in 53 kickback schemes over a five-year period. The only charge Bobby Davids and the others faced was one count of mail fraud. The rest of us were pretty much beside ourselves. It didn't bode well for us that the government was willing to let these people off so lightly in exchange for their testimony against us. We had also found that Bobby had been having an affair with a woman in the accounting department. She was a CPA and the comptroller for the dealer acquisition program. To a large part, it was her cooperation that allowed Bobby to get his schemes past accounting, the auditors, and the executives. Yet she was not charged at all. It was at that point that I started to realize just how much the cards were stacked against us. The government was letting admittedly guilty people go in order to get their testimony. These people were just pointing up the ladder to get the spotlight off themselves. Regardless, the story in the papers read that some medical manager executives had pleaded guilty to being involved in accounting fraud, and more people were likely to be charged. The whole thing was a PR nightmare for WebMD and the Medical Manager Practice Services Division. The last thing in the world I wanted to do was hurt the company. After 25 years of committed service, it was time to resign. On February 9th, 2005, I sent my resignation letter to WebMD's CEO. It may well be the only resignation letter written under these circumstances that was ever signed, with great love and respect. I meant every word of it. I was amazed that after all those years, my interstate was not affected by leaving the company. I woke up the next morning, went to the temple as I always did, and then walked up to the old personalized programming office building on temple grounds. That building had been converted into a house, but no one was living there. My old office had been used as a study, and it still had the same desk and furniture as 15 years earlier. I found that I was just as comfortable with this office as I was with the executive suite down the road. In fact, I was more comfortable. I had always liked simplicity. That's why I had moved out to the woods in the first place. Sitting quietly in that office, I could see that this terrible situation was bringing about amazing changes, both inside and out. Life had always done that to me, and accepting those changes was my great experiment. I knew that this attack by the government was no exception. I just had to be willing to go wherever it took me. In the meantime, I had been given the space to begin writing the books I always knew I was going to write. There were two of them. The first would impart what I had learned since first noticing my mental voice talking while I was sitting on that couch so many years ago. It would be a journey back to the seat of self that could be taken by anyone in the world. It was to be called The Untethered Soul. The second book would be the stories of the miraculous flow of events that happened over the years as I let go and let life unfold naturally. It would be called The Surrender Experiment. I couldn't start that book yet because I had no idea how this latest chapter would play out. So in the midst of all this change and uncertainty, I began working on The Untethered Soul. Karen Entner had lived at the temple for more than 15 years. She had grown into a management position at Medical Manager, where she was a phenomenally productive employee. As head of the documentation and computer-based training departments, she had been writing under my supervision for years. Shortly after I left the company, she expressed an interest in helping with my book. So now I had a book to write and the perfect person to assist in the process. The temple, the book, and periodic conversations with Randy and his team kept me plenty busy for the rest of the year. By November 2005, a full 2 years after the raid, Randy was hearing that an indictment was imminent. He and some of the other attorneys demanded to see evidence tying their clients to a crime. The result was that Randy sent me a 1-inch thick stack of documents that the government intended to use to prove that I was behind Bobby's activities. I was very interested in getting to study this material, yet at the same time I was somewhat apprehensive. After only a few hours, I was flabbergasted. I did not see anything in these documents that incriminated me. There were some accounting reports on a few acquisitions Bobby had done, but most of the rest were handwritten notes my assistant Sandy had taken during our twice-weekly executive calls. On these notes, the FBI had circled pretty much every reference to any discussions we had about meeting our quarterly revenue and earnings projections. Sandy had scribbled my name next to some of the comments or suggestions. That was about it. I was both relieved and concerned. I was relieved because, as I suspected, they didn't find anything indicating I had done anything wrong. I felt concerned because they were obviously considering these circled documents as evidence against me. I didn't know what to think, so I called Randy. Randy told me that everyone who had looked at the documents had the same reaction. There was nothing in them that tied me to any wrongdoing. Randy explained that it didn't matter. Bobby had said that the accounting fraud he had been involved in was for the purpose of meeting Wall Street's numbers. These documents would be used to show motive. The government prosecutors would argue that since I wanted to meet Wall Street's expectations, I allowed Bobby to do things improperly. Motive was one of the pieces the government needed in order to try to build a case against me. But this wasn't just happening to me. Randy told me that every one of the other executives and their attorneys